Welcome to the Opium Den. I'm Daniel Williams. This is Sunday, June 14th, 2009, and we are doing our interview series today, and we'll be speaking in just a moment with Sebastian Seville. And Sebastian is the executive director of a UK Great Britain drug policy reform group called RELEASE. And RELEASE was founded in 1967, way back when the drug use kind of exploded onto a scene, both here and across the pond. It was founded in 1967 specifically to defend the rights of drug users. How quaint and how absolutely necessary. And with RELEASE, obviously, civil liberties have always been central to the principles of RELEASE. So without further ado, we're going to call Sebastian over in the UK. He's agreed to speak to us from his home this evening at 6:30 in the evening over there. So let's hit the Skype button and give Sebastian a call. I love Skype. And that's my phone ringing in the other room. Come on now.
Hi.
Well, hello, Sebastian. Daniel Williams. Welcome to the Opium Den.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be in the Opium Den, especially with you, Daniel.
Well, I appreciate you taking the time today from a very busy schedule. It's a Sunday over there, and all of our listeners appreciate the fact that you've taken the time to speak with us. At the top of the show, when I introduced it, I talked about RELEASE, and I talked about it was founded in 1967, and that you took over as executive director in 2003.
That's right.
Yes, and what caught my eye of RELEASE, and I'm ashamed to admit that I was not aware of your group until just recently, but your bus billboard program campaign raised quite a stir over here in the drug policy reform blogs. And I wanted to open up by talking about that. You have these big billboards on the sides of buses that say, "Nice people take drugs," and I found that extremely refreshing. And I wanted to have you tell us how that came about and what were the repercussions from that.
Surely, Daniel. At RELEASE, and indeed myself personally, have long felt that the drug policy discussion needs to sort of move out to wider audiences. And we need to sort of find a way of engaging with the general public so they can start thinking about this more than relying on the information they get in the press in the UK. So we worked out that we could afford to put out a campaign on these buses, and we got a very sort of reduced rate. And then we thought, well, what four or five words could we put together that would be, you know, that would catch the eye and deliver the type of message that we believe in. And I must say, the day we spent brainstorming on that was fascinating. But at the end of the day, we came up with "Nice people take drugs." There was some discussion on whether it should be "Nice people also take drugs" or "Nice people take drugs too." Finally, we felt that we didn't want to dilute the message at all, and saying "nice people take drugs too" sort of implied that most people took drugs weren't nice, but there were a few that were. And that's certainly not what we wanted to say.
Well, I think it's a very succinct message, and it certainly resonated with me and a lot of the people over here that were exposed to it on the drug policy blogs. The one that came to my attention was "Drug Warrant." I don't know if you've ever read Pete Geithner's blog, but he's a pretty smart fellow over here and a friend of mine. The one question I have, "Nice people take drugs," I think, as I mentioned, is very, very succinct. What did the bus companies think of this program?
Well, this is the interesting thing. When we first went to them, we went to them with "Nice people take drugs," thinking, well, we were wondering whether that would sort of be even considered. And 2 hours later, we got a call. You see, in the UK, it's not actually the bus company you go to. There's a contractor where the bus company outsource the advertising too. So you approach the contractor.
Mm-hmm.
That's CBS Outdoors, it's called here in the UK. And we approach them, and 2 hours later, we got a call saying that was fine, and please could we provide the artwork? So we got our people print, you know, working on a banner that would fit with our, you know, with our website and other publications. And we sent it up to them, and sure enough, 4 days later, on June the 1st, there were 25 double-decker buses rolling back and forth across London with Nice People Take Drugs on the outside, and another 100 buses with it on the inside.
How did you feel when that first happened, when you saw your first bus? Was there a sense of pride? Was there a sense of, you know, what was your emotional reaction to it?
The funny thing was, of course, that none of us could find a bus for the first day. And then suddenly, one of the release staff was down in a real central part of London. And she jumped on her cell phone and called back to the office and said, I've just seen three go around the roundabout all together, and it's amazing. And she took some pictures with her cell phone, one of the release lawyers, and emailed them back to the office. And it was a really exciting moment. We all felt terrific. And boy, from that moment on, the emails and blogs and articles in the press were amazing. And, you know, we were so thoroughly prepared for some really negative press, and none came. That was what was amazing.
Now, is the campaign still going on, or was it just a limited period?
Well, no. This is the big story. Is that okay? On Monday, June the 1st, the buses get rolling, and we have a contract that the buses run for a month.
Wow,
25 buses for the busiest month of the year in London. June is, you know, when most people are outdoors, and many tourists are here. Wimbledon starts. I mean, there's a lot of activity in central London. On Friday, which is the fifth, we get a call from CBS saying that the bus companies called them and they're concerned about the signs, and CBS refer it to there's a body called CAP here, and CAP advised them that if a member of the public was to complain, that potentially the Advertising Standards Committee may find that it was potentially an offensive message. And although they didn't advise them to take it down, they suggested that it may get them into some sort of trouble. So they called us and said, we're very sorry, but these signs have got to come down. Now, half of us were, half of me and the team were really upset and really sad, but of course the story suddenly became much bigger. And the press got hold of it, and it was Nice People Take Drugs, signs pulled by bus company. I mean, it was the headlines. And it's, I mean, the amount of interest it's generated has been immense, you know, right across the world. I mean, we've seen blogs in Russia, in Australia, in Asia, in the United States, in Latin America, in a multitude of different languages, really kind of really latched onto this phrase, Nice People Take Drugs. And it also translates quite nicely into other languages too, because of the simplicity of the statement.
Now, all the uproar that resulted from this, did that help take some of the attention away from the expenses scandal that's going on over there? Or?
Well, funny enough, I was interviewed on one of the London radio stations the other morning by a guy who clearly agreed that Nice People Take Drugs, you know, and we were talking away, and he said, with all the MP's expenses scandal, I suppose this may divert it a bit. But that is unless we can find an MP who's played expenses for drugs. You know? And that would be a real story.
We'll probably get the greatest amount of sympathy from all of the Londoners over there. Well, at least he's buying weed instead of, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
So the response from the public and from the publications has it been universally supported, or have you had some detractors?
Well, okay, if you read the blogs, I would say, a rough estimate, 8.5, 9 out of 10 have been supportive, and the one and a half that haven't been supportive haven't been super anti, but they've just sort of suggested that, you know, is this encouraging young people to take drugs? Is this condoning drug use? Is are all people who take drugs all nice? Maybe getting a bit nitpicky on the minutia. But the interesting thing is, of course, we've been offered, by, because we have a contract and they've taken them all down, they've offered us twice as many buses with a different, if we come up with a different slogan, which is acceptable. So this weekend we've been sort of thinking, you know, do we want to tweak the slogan slightly and get it on twice as many buses and get twice as many people seeing it? Or do we want to stand firm? And this will be the release campaign that was banned from the buses. My everything natural in me says we should go with the, you know, with the latter, but to stick, to stand firm with nice people take drugs, and that'll be the slogan that was deemed too controversial for London buses, which frankly is appalling, but will generate a lot of publicity and will get a lot of people talking, and that's what we want to do, get people talking about drugs, because they don't, they just, drugs are some sort of strange thing which a handful of people do, which is, of course, is completely not the truth, because we estimate that at least half of all the adults in the UK, I mean, the official figures are more than a third. You know, we would say that it's probably more likely to be at least half of all the adults in the UK have tried drugs. So,
so do you intend to stand pat and let the nice people take drugs banners come down and then just work the publicity from that? Or?
Well, they've come down.
They're already down.
Oh, they're already down. But it's still running in the press. So there's still pictures of the buses with nice people take drugs on the side in newspapers, in blogs. Every time you turn on your computer, you see that another 10,000 people have typed nice people take drugs into Google. And, so it's...
Did you get a refund?
Well, we haven't paid. No, of course, we didn't pay in advance. So I have the invoice sitting on my desk. Which gives me a slightly warm feeling of the weekend here.
Oh, absolutely. Well, you know, you mentioned the fact that official figures over there are a third of the population. You think is probably closer to half or better, and I tend to believe that as well. That it's closer to the half mark. Here in the U.S., we have our government releases figures on drug use, and you can always count on them to undervalue certain aspects for propaganda purposes. But they're willing to say that half of the adults here in the United States have done an illegal drug at least once in their lifetime, with marijuana being the drug of choice, so to speak. And I've been paying attention to drug prohibition since 1968. I'm kind of an old guy. I'll be 59 in a week or so. But over the years, I was in business and did fairly well, and retired in 95 to focus full time on drug policy. But what I have found is that, and you may have the same finding over there, is that the majority of people here in the U.S. are way ahead of the politicians on this issue. We had a Zogby poll that showed 76% of the American adults believe the drug war has failed. So that is a fairly large constituency. But what we have here is somewhat of a catch-22. Our politicians, you know, I've spoken to a number of our congresspeople, and then privately they agree that the drug war has failed, but they're afraid to say so publicly because of the backlash from voters. And when I talk to people privately, they agree that the drug wars failed, but they're afraid to speak up because they don't believe the politicians will follow them, or that if they do speak up, there'll be recriminations, either, you know, personal or business. So it's very interesting that the amount of people who believe the drug war has failed, both here in your country, is leading the charge, so to speak. But do you have a similar situation in the UK with politicians who privately think that it's a losing proposition but are afraid to speak up publicly? How does that work over there?
Absolutely. I mean, what you just said could be something I'd say. It's kind of like the story of the emperor has no clothes. And if you speak to politicians off the record, they'll kind of agree. And then the next day, you'll see them on TV thumping their drum about how they're going to get tougher on drug users and tougher on drug dealers and stamp out this the evil scourge of drugs, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So then you match that up against the fact that half the adult population have taken drugs or something. So how does that fit? And it seems to be a bit of a disjoint somewhere. And that's really what the So Nice People Take Drugs campaign, and indeed another project I'm involved with called TalkingDrugs.org, which is a new sort of global website in a number of languages, where we want, the drug policy reform sort of debate has got quite insular, I think, over the last few years. You go to conferences and stuff, and you see, great people doing great work, but you think, people that really need to be here aren't here. It's the guy in the street, the guy who works in the shop down the road. They need to be at these places and be exposed to some of the facts. And that's really where I think the hard work lies in the future. It's not persuading a handful of politicians.
Yeah, it's getting more of a grassroots type of...
Absolutely. And not only people who are sort of, who like drugs, who take drugs now and then or have done, but even those people who think drugs are so dangerous and damaging, to have them on board, that the policies that currently exist make things worse.
Exactly. I mean, a lot of the people that I speak with that don't like drugs per se or don't do drugs recreationally, they are beginning to believe that our drug laws are actually worse than drug use itself. So it's not just the people that get high that are behind this wave of change. It is the average citizen on the street who is becoming of the opinion that the drug war is just not working. But go ahead.
Right.
No, go ahead.
And I think we need to get more of those people speaking up. For example, the recent sort of cannabis fiasco in the UK, where it was reclassified downwards to C, and then there was a huge frenzy in the press about the association with mental health problems, etc. And certain members of the press would wheel out a sort of concerned mom whose son had suffered a psychotic episode on cannabis. And they'd say, see, what you pro-drug people want to do, you want to have more of this. And you could, often you'd see the concerned mom kind of not really believing that the same old policies are making any difference. But wanting to understand that different policies would work for them too. And I think once we can get people understanding that, I think it'll be a big step forward. The other thing is, acceptable language for politicians. It's still hard for mainstream politicians to stand up and say, I stand for drug policy reform. That still kind of introduces a glass ceiling for them where they're not going to get elected to certain office. But for a politician to say, I stand for improved control or reduced access for kids,
right. Exactly. That's the approach I think they should take, because you're exactly right. If they stand up and say, "Well, I think drug prohibition is wrong," they're going to take some hits. But if they couch it in the vernacular of, saving the children, which seems to be the big Rubicon that everybody does, they can get along better. But with your nice people take drugs, what I really like about that is two things. One, it addresses the issue of the large amount of people, or the overwhelming number of people who do drugs recreationally, do so responsibly. And when you look at the alcohol lobby, one of the main proponents or the main caveats of the alcohol industry is that it's the responsibility, or the responsibility rule, meaning that the overwhelming majority of people who consume alcohol do so responsibly, and it's just a few bad apples out there that give it a give it a bad name. And I like the nice people take drugs approach, because you're doing the same thing. You're saying that, yes, there are problems with drugs, but you know, the what you're implying is that the overwhelming majority who do drugs recreationally do so responsibly. And that's a message that we're not getting out here in the United States. And I wanted you to kind of give us an idea of, you know, why that made the most sense to you guys to approach it in that respect, to make aware of all the people, or to champion all the people who do drugs responsibly.
Yes, but I would add to that that we would also say that, you know, even, you know, the people who get into desperate problems with drugs like, you know, heroin, crack cocaine, methamphetamine, they're nice people too. So it's not, what we're careful not to do is to say, well, it's only the nice people that do drugs in a responsible way, and the others are like not nice. So I think that's a road we don't want to go down. But indeed, what you just said also, we support very strongly that the majority of people who take drugs seem to do so without suffering the consequences that one would believe if one believed everything one read in the press.
Well, the approach that you're taking, again, you know, I commend you and congratulate you, and I wish that our drug policy reform leaders here in the United States would take that approach. We seem to be mired in the controversy of medical marijuana. That seems to be our cause célèbre over here, and I'm one of the very few drug policy advocates who believe that the medical marijuana issue is the wrong strategy to move the drug debate forward, and I'm hoping that people like Ethan Nadelman, I know you're aware of Ethan and Alan St. Pierre of Normal, I'm hoping that there can be some, like a contact high, so to speak, from you guys over there across the pond to make them a little more, you know, to embolden them to take that approach over here and move it out of the medicinal arena. Most of the people who consume cannabis are not, you know, technically sick individuals. The medical marijuana users are a very small percentage of the overall, you know, drug-consuming public. And I'm not here to say medical marijuana is a bad idea. I think it's great. I've met, you know, hundreds of medical marijuana patients, and I'm completely on board with the efficacy of cannabis. But I think it's the wrong approach. And I'd like your comments on how you see the U.S. approaching drug policy reform versus the way you guys and Transform do it over in the UK?
Well, I mean, first of all, I guess in the states where medical marijuana is allowed, I mean, you are ahead of us. You know, when you can't get medical marijuana in the UK, indeed anywhere in Europe, unless, of course, you go to Holland where you can get it anyway. But I think this ties in nicely to this whole. I was at the UN, you know, the high-level meeting after, you know, the 10-year strategy meeting in March in Vienna. And one of the questions I posed was that, okay, so you senior government officials, you've moved a little bit, and you'll say that, treatment's better for the sort of so-called victims and addicts who use drugs, and you stick by your mantra of, you know, extreme punishment for supplying and trafficking. But what about the vast majority of people who take drugs, who aren't addicts, who aren't taking it for medicinal purposes, who aren't supplying? What about them? And there seems to be a kind of, as though they're in complete denial that these people don't exist. They're sort of, if they're just starting to take drugs, they're kind of on their way to becoming a victim who will end up needing treatment. Yet they accept readily that you can drink socially. And it just seems that's a big hurdle. I think some politicians obviously do understand this, but the ones who are in charge of the sort of, like at the United Nations Office of Drug Control, they just will not even entertain that the majority of the drugs which they're concerned about are consumed by otherwise law-abiding citizens who have jobs and bring up families and go to school, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, how do they reconcile what is going on in Portugal since 2001 and what's been going on in Holland for a number of years? How do they reconcile that with their belief that you know, people who do drugs or, you know, are bad and they're going to get into trouble. Did they just ignore the Portugal and Holland experiment, or do they have, what did they say that to dismiss that?
Let's face it, Daniel, that, you know, politicians are notoriously good at ignoring evidence. You know, you can drive up to a politician's house with, you know, 15 trucks of worthy papers by the most eminent scientists of the world showing A equals B, and unless it fits with what they want to do at that moment, they ignore it. Interestingly, when they want to put forward something, they'll find one obscure, tiny piece of evidence which supports what they want to do anyway. So I don't think we must be sort of fooled into thinking that if something's working, you can go and show politicians that it's working, and somehow they'll go, oh, okay, well, we've been wrong all this time, so let's change stuff. Really, until there's a kind of a sort of greater number of people who are prepared to stand up and say, on drug policy, the emperor's got no clothes on. There needs to be change. And then politicians will go, right, you know, there's votes in this. And I think at the moment they're sort of on the edge a bit. They're on the fence. They're kind of thinking, well, we're not quite convinced that there's enough votes yet to come out and say, and the huge flack we'll get in the press if we do go down that side will be, you know, soft on crime, giving up the drug war, you know, anything that makes politicians sound weak is always disastrous as far as they're concerned.
Well, I think they need to be able to find the strength in that wisdom to be honest.
Absolutely. I mean, I've had off the record discussions with politicians here who said what we really need is a sort of someone to come up with a transition strategy, was the word he used actually, was how we get from where we are now to a place where there is some sort of regulated market. I think that's one of the big problems, that we can describe what a regulated market might look like, and, you know, how do you get from where we are now to there?
You're exactly right.
Political force. Excuse me, sorry.
No. I wanted to amplify your point. You're exactly right. But where I believe the debate needs to go is not the right or wrong issue of it all, but what would the landscape resemble if we were to repeal drug prohibition and put in a regulated market to control the sale and distribution of these substances? That's where I believe the debate needs to go, and I think that's where we'll be able to score most with the citizens out there, is to describe, paint the picture of what repeal would look like and how we would go about implementing that. And that's what I think is very important, and it seems to be lacking considerably here in the U.S. and other places. Now, I've traveled extensively, and I've found that most people overseas know more about our politics than we do. I mean, they seem to follow the United States. So I wanted to ask you, I'm going to make the assumption, which is always kind of dicey, but I'm going to make the assumption that you followed our campaign fairly well, and specifically with regard to drug policy. And I wanted you to, if you would, for our listeners, compare your thoughts on candidate Obama versus President Obama with regard specifically to drug policy.
Well, with what I know and what I read and saw, there was, you know, great optimism that if candidate Obama became President Obama, things could potentially move forward significantly in drug policy reform. I think now that he is president, yeah, he's in the real world, and obviously there's a lot of other issues he's got on his plate, which are, he probably sees as higher up the agenda than drug policy reform.
But he didn't seem to have any qualms about making it not a signature issue of his candidacy, but also an important issue. He courted all of the younger voters, talking about he's on record of the drug war being an utter failure, and that he was going to implement the clean needle exchange program. So he made it a fairly, you know, important part of his candidacy, and a lot of young people responded to not only his charisma and the like, but more specifically to his common sense approach to drug policy. And now he's done a complete 180 as president. And what we're starting to sense over here, and young people are very fickle anyway, but we're starting to sense that a lot of the young people who voted for him, either altruistically for his entire program or more specifically for his drug policy approach, they're not very happy with President Obama, and they're wondering why he can't come out and make some type of game-changing statement. And it appears that the excuse given mostly by the Obama administration is that the president has too much on his plate right now and doesn't want to sacrifice the political capital to make any type of statement. And I take the exact opposite, and I'm wondering if you agree with me that because there's such a large, you know, a number of Americans who believe the drug war is failing, maybe not believing that repealing prohibition across the board is the answer, but this is an important issue. He wouldn't cost him much political capital to come out and make a statement, even if it was as small as taking marijuana out of Schedule A or pardoning Charlie Lynch from the dispensary. Yeah. So what, when they tell me that he's got too much to do, this isn't important, I think that's bullshit.
No, I agree. I mean,
it's total bullshit.
I agree. I think for a start, I mean, the fact that you have 2.3 million people in your prisons.
It's an embarrassment, an absolute embarrassment.
That's something which should be tackled right away. I mean,
the majority of them
are there for drug-related, and the majority for very minor drug-related.
If we were able to pardon Richard Nixon, the asshole that started this whole fucking thing, if we could pardon that son of a bitch, why can't we pardon all nonviolent drug offenders in our prisons and jails?
Absolutely. I mean, I just think this goes back to, you know, the reality of politics. I'm not saying it's right. I'm just saying that, you know, people will say things or appear to court people by suggesting that they're going to do things. But when they actually get into office, I remember when Tony Blair came into office in 1997, we'd had 16 years of continuous conservative rule. Margaret Thatcher followed by John Major. I mean, the optimism that was here in London was amazing. You know, things were really going to change. And in fact, over the last 10 years, they've actually got worse. I'm not suggesting that's going to happen in the United States, but I remember feeling, you know, really elated when Tony Blair got elected, and things didn't change. I mean, we got the reduction in classification of cannabis from a Class B to a qualified Class C drug, and then the following 4 years, it was, you know, used politically by the incumbent party to appear tough. They were going to reconsider this, and after the second time that they chose to ignore our group of experts and move it back to B. So what the president in your country actually believes on drugs, I don't know. I mean, I've read some of his books, and he certainly has used drugs. It would appear that the rest of his policies would be in line with understanding that locking a million people in jails for using drugs is completely wrong, and to get them out as quickly as possible should be done.
Well, so it's obvious that his
maybe it's a second term. I mean, you know, there's always that: is it a second term plan? You know, once a president, at least in the United States, you don't have the possibility of people being elected on and on and on and on. So in the second term, potentially they can
do the hard things.
Do things without worrying about how they're going to be elected or not for a third term. So maybe it's a second term issue for him.
Well, it's certainly obvious that his drug use as a younger man didn't impede his ability to succeed. And the only thing that would have kept him drug-related wise from going into the Oval Office here is had he been caught. So I think it's the height of hypocrisy for him to continue these draconian drug policies and putting at risk all the future Obamas of the world for being, you know, caught up in the vagaries and the and the indiscriminate enforcement of our drug policies, basically telling everybody, you know, I didn't get caught, but, you know, good luck out there. And if you get caught, well, you're fucked. And if you don't, maybe you'll grow up to be president.
I mean, he could have been in the wrong party on the wrong day, and there'd be no President Obama now. I mean, we've got several politicians over here like that. You know, the ones who said, well, yes, when I was at university, I did smoke a bit of pot. And you just want to say to them, well, can't you understand then that if you happen to cross the street at the wrong time or be in the wrong car and you've been searched and they'd found it, you wouldn't be a politician then. And you couldn't be. And
be
I wonder how many remarkable people there are in America with records who will never be able to do stuff like that.
Well, you're absolutely right. And another issue that we have going on over here, and I don't want to focus on the U.S. because I want to know more about the U.K., but we have what's being touted as President Obama's Trojan horse. Senator Jim Webb, Democrat from Virginia, has the National Criminal Justice Commission Act of 2009, which is an 18-month-long commission to look at our criminal justice system, and the majority of the parts of this commission are going to be drug related, and they're saying, they tell me, Ethan and all the guys tell me to, you know, shut the fuck up and quit rocking the boat, because this is the Trojan horse. And what I tell them is, well, okay, let's assume this is the Trojan horse. We have this commission that's going to probably take 24 months, at least 2 years to complete from start to finish, and during that time, approximately 1.5 million Americans, mostly younger ones, will be arrested for the nonviolent simple possession of marijuana and be thrown into the criminal justice system that Jim Webb is ostensibly trying to remedy. And why shouldn't the president come out and say, during this length of this commission, let's do like an ollie-ollie-in free on marijuana, or at least take it out of Schedule One, or not put anybody in jail during this commission. But he's not even willing to do that. So I'm not so certain that this commission that Jim Webb is going to have any value. I've seen blue ribbon commissions come and go in the past 40 years of my political involvement. Most of them are just stall tactics, and even the good and the bad are routinely ignored. So I'm not real comfortable with my drug policy brethren over here telling me to, you know, quit rocking the boat and quit criticizing Obama, because he's our guy, and he's going to do something. So with regards to UK politicians, do you think Gordon Brown is somebody who can do this, or do you think what's the fellow, Cameron, the guy from
the Conservative? No, I mean, Gordon Brown is, well, in all likelihood, his days are very numbered, yeah? Whether he actually makes it to the next election as leader, or if he does make it to the next election, I think it's highly unlikely that he's going to be re-elected. So then you've got Cameron, who's the head of the Conservatives, who, interestingly enough, you know, several years ago, when he was on one of the select committees here on drugs, he came out quite strongly and said that he could see a time when we may have to revisit all the United Nations conventions.
Right. That's
when politicians move up the ladder, it's amazing how they quickly distance themselves from anything controversial to do with drugs. And that's just
that's
just a given for politicians here in the United States, you know, anywhere.
Well, I tend to look at
the Liberal Democrats are the interesting party here, because
fuck the Democrats.
The Liberal Democrats here, you know, have teetered along with about 15 to 20% of the vote, and we've had meetings with them, and we've said, listen, well, why don't you come out and be the party that says, you know, we want to reform the drug laws? You're going to immediately attract a lot of younger people, a lot of not so young people, a lot of people who are fed up with Labour because of the Iraq War, a lot of people who are fed up with Labour because they've been in power too long, but a lot of people who wouldn't vote Conservative because they just never would vote Conservative. And, yeah, when we had the initial meetings, it was all very enthusiastic, and we come down and have meetings to discuss kind of potential, you know, strategies and policies. But, you know, when push came to shove, it was, no, well, again, it's a, we can't do anything now, even if we wanted to, because of the United Nations. So they used that to fall back on.
Yeah, it's like, well, of course,
we go back to them and say, well, until countries start doing stuff, the United Nations is never going to do stuff. So,
well, you know, I think this is a more of a conservative issue than a liberal issue. I wrote a book in 2004 called The Naked Truth About Drugs, and in that book, I
have a copy on order.
Ah, well, thank you very much. But anyway, in that book, I wrote about the liberal and conservative press here in our country, and I wrote back then that the Wall Street Journal was the only newspaper I believe that had the balls to take this issue head on, because it is a conservative issue. It's a civil liberties, it's a personal freedom, personal responsibility issue, and I took a lot of shit for that because I was, you know, denigrating the liberal press and promoting the Wall Street Journal. But I've been a subscriber and a reader for almost 25 years, and I think it's one of the best newspapers around. But what they've done recently, in the past 18 months, 2 years, they have devoted more ink to the drug war and drug prohibition than any other newspaper, liberal newspaper or not, here in the U.S. And just Saturday, they had a front page, full front page story on the drug war in Mexico. So I think it's more of a conservative issue, and they should be the ones that our drug policy reform guys go after. But it seems that Ethan and all the guys like to hang out with the Democrats because they have just this visceral anger at the conservatives. But I think it's a conservative issue. What's your feel?
Well, I mean, I suppose it's what you mean. It's the going on the sort of libertarian tack that,
correct, know, yes,
people should have some freedom of choice and less of the nanny state telling them what they can and can't do. Yeah, I mean, I agree with some of that. I do think that drug, you know, the drug war, so to speak, has been brought about, as well as stopping people taking drugs, has been brought about largely to control certain groups in our society. So I think that to just go exclusively down the libertarian track could be sort of dangerous in some ways, that it's kind of not accepting that, you know, I've heard some of the tapes, you know, when the civil rights movement was getting going in the 50s and 60s, there were Republican politicians talking about, you know, what can we do to sort of undermine this? How about building a more effective war on drugs? You know? So perhaps some of that is it needs looking at too. But with regard to the conservative politicians here in the UK, of course, the difference we have here is they are likely to be the next party in power here. I think the Republicans in the United States are probably, I mean, unless something...
They're fucked.
They're probably, yeah, that's the word I was looking for, yeah. But probably at least for another two elections.
Yeah.
So I think there is... mileage in courting the conservative politicians here in the UK. But again, I think it won't be about how using drugs is okay and stuff. It's more about how drugs are completely out of control now and how we can have regulatory systems where they're more effectively controlled and less accessible to kids.
Well, here in the U.S., as you mentioned, the Republican Party is in the wilderness now, and they're groping around for issues that can revitalize them and open up their tent to more and more people. And it boggles me that Ron Paul, who was one of our presidential candidates for the Republican Party, he raised $37 million, mostly from young people, almost exclusively from young people, based upon two critical positions. I mean, he had a lot of things to say, but, you know, if you can get somebody on one or two, they'll follow you on everything else. But the majority of his money was raised due to his opposition to the wars in the Middle East and wanting to bring all of our troops home from around the world, not just the Middle East, and on ending the drug war. He raised $37 million and he received over 1.5 million votes during all the primaries. This is an issue that the Republican Party should seize upon if they want to bring in young people to the party, show themselves as being the party of personal responsibility. And I'm just wondering why, I mean, they, like I said, they're grasping at straws, and what can we do to bring our party back into prominence when this one issue which is an extremely important issue for a lot of people, is laying right in front of them. And
well, I think, as I said at the beginning, that I'm going back to Nice People Take Drugs, and indeed our other project, TalkingDrugs.org, it's about getting this talked about by a much wider audience, and talked about not just about for or against, or, you know, do you use drugs or don't you use drugs, or have you ever used drugs or have you never used drugs, but the consequences of the war on drugs for everybody, even those people who've got two kids who died from drugs, or those people who've got kids who are in prison for 40 years for drugs, how the war on drugs is worse for those people as well. And I think that's a really important avenue. Another thing I think is important, another analogy I use is, if you go back 25 years and you look at the Green Movement, I mean, 25 years ago, we're talking about a handful of people hugging trees in the rainforest. But with you know, effective communication and talking to people, it's become so mainstream now that, you know, people's six-year-old kids are turning around and telling you, you know, punishing you because you throw your aluminum can in the wrong trash can.
Mm-hmm.
It's become mainstream. And I think drug policy has historically been quite discussed in the margins too much. And it needs to be discussed by everybody. And once it's discussed by everybody, people will eventually start thinking, well, there are better ways to deal with this, even if I hate drugs. There are better ways to deal with this if I love drugs. And I think it's our job, people like us, to maybe not spend so much time talking to each other at conferences, at functions, but to get out in the world and tell people, listen, start talking and thinking about drugs and how it's affecting your community, even if you hate them.
Absolutely. I think the discussion needs to move to that forefront. What about the economic collapse? Do you see that as being an accelerator to some of this? Because there's nothing that focuses the mind more than being broke.
Yeah, and absolutely. We've had discussions about that here in the UK about, you know, will a recession, you know, focus people's mind? Will they start thinking, well, you know, we'd rather see more, you know, preschool education for our kids than people being arrested for smoking marijuana? And if there's a choice of one or the other, because of the recession, we'll go with, you know, preschool education for our kids. But of course, the numbers have become so big now. You know, when we hear about, you know, $700 billion for bailing out Wall Street and another $100 billion bailing out the, you know, car industry, suddenly the figures which are spent on the war on drugs don't sound as giant as they did a couple of years ago.
Well, that's a very good point, and I hadn't thought of it in that perspective. But that is a very good point.
I do think that you can still effectively use that mechanism of saying to people, listen, you know, this is just crazy. We're spending billions of pounds, dollars, euros every year prosecuting a completely ineffective war that is, you know, drugs are just everywhere. You can throw a rock wherever you're standing in London in any direction, and it'll hit someone who's either buying, selling, or using drugs, you know. And this idea that it's being controlled is just crazy. And we had a big announcement recently by the equivalent of your FBI. We call it SOCA here.
Mm-hmm.
They came out all loud and proud because allegedly the wholesale price of cocaine had gone up by 20% in the last 8 months. And they saw that as, you know, well, the drug policy reform people are always telling us that an indicator of success would be, you know, an increase in price. But of course, what they hadn't taken into account was that, you know, the UK currency had devalued by exactly the same amount in that 8 month period. And of course, the big end suppliers, you know, don't deal in pounds, they deal in dollars. So they say, well, you know, we want the same amount of dollars we got last month, not less.
right.
So it's kind of like a naivety. And, you know, you get people saying, oh, well, they caught 3 tons of cocaine in a boat off the south coast of England. You say, well, the cocaine's still everywhere. So actually, when you say that you caught 3 tons or 30 tons or, and it's still everywhere, that should show you how ineffective the war is.
Yeah, that'll scare the shit out of you, you know, if you're...
Yeah, exactly. You know, but it doesn't. And drugs have got progressively kind of, I guess, the word I'd use is nastier, you know?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, you've got, you know, crack cocaine, you've got methamphetamine, and here in the UK, I mean, in the 60s, 70s, even the early 80s, there was a wide variety of cannabis available in London,
mm-hmm.
of different strengths, of different types. You know, hashish from Afghanistan, Pakistan, Lebanon, Morocco, marijuana from the Caribbean, Hawaii, Thailand,
yeah.
You know, Africa. Now there's two types of cannabis available here in the UK. There's hydroponically grown, what is known in the press as skunk here, or rather sort of mixed of hash from what started off in Morocco and has been reconstituted in Europe with all sorts in it. And that's just as a direct result of prohibition, because why would you want to ship in, you know, 10 types of cannabis from
right.
parts of the world when you can grow it in a warehouse down the road? I mean, the senior police officer in one of the senior police officers in Yorkshire in the papers the other day said, okay, we catch three of these grow houses every week, but we know there are, you know, six more jump up when we catch three, so we're fighting a losing battle, with his own words.
Well, you touched on an issue that I wanted to speak with you. Here in the U.S., we have this deal where our prohibitionists say that the THC content of cannabis has grown so much that, you know, they say it's not your father's cannabis anymore. But there's two things that I would like to rebut on that, and like your thoughts as well. I think it's a good thing that the quality levels have gone up. You have to smoke less. And secondly, back in the 60s, we had very high quality cannabis, Ybalka Purple Gold, Panama Red. It just didn't seem to be as prevalent. So I think the idea that attacking marijuana as being more dangerous, i.e., more potent than it's been before, is just another little red herring. And how does that? What do you think about that?
So, well, exactly what you said. And the interesting thing is that, okay, you're absolutely right. Back in the 60s, 70s, there was cannabis just as strong as there is now, but maybe not quite as widely available. And there were other types of cannabis which were sort of medium strength, low strength, high strength. But now, because of prohibition, people grow this one type of cannabis in the grow houses here. And of course, they're going to grow
the most profitable product.
As profitable they can. So you could say that strong cannabis is more widely available to people now. But that is as a result of prohibition.
Exactly, back when
the problem which, you know, they describe as, well, the stronger cannabis now is, you know, our kids are smoking strong cannabis. Yes, because of what you've done.
I agree. Back when prohibition was ushered in with the Harrison Narcotics Act, prior to that, with the Harrison Narcotics Act of 1914, prior to that, you could get opium, you could get laudanum, you could get morphine, and you could get heroin. And once we put the prohibition against drugs, all of those lesser potent varieties went away because all the traffickers wanted to settle on the most portable or the most profitable product. So we have heroin. So your point is exactly right. Very.
You think people would really understand that? Because, I mean, all you have to do is look at prohibition of alcohol. Suddenly, beer was almost impossible to get.
It was.
Wine
exactly.
was almost impossible to get.
Exactly.
The rich drank imported brandy, and the poor drank moonshine.
Yeah.
And that's kind of what you've got in drugs now. You've got, you know, none of the kind of more subtle varieties available. And if you're wealthy, you can get some good quality cocaine and stuff. And if you're poor in a city, you get crack or
right.
meth out in the countryside in
right.
the States.
Well, the exact opposite I see happening in the hallucinogenic market. Back in the 60s, and one of my interviews is with Nick Sand. He was a legendary
mm-hmm.
60s chemist. Back then, when LSD was at its height of popularity, at least from the media perspective, it was very easy to get very high quality, high microgram dose. 250, 300 micrograms was pretty much the standard dosage level of LSD. It was very clean and very pure. And when I talked to Nick Sand, and I said, well, Nick, I said, the LSD that we find today is a little, not nearly as clean, and it's anywhere from 75 to 100 mics per hit, not like the old days. And I said, I mentioned the fact that, you know, with Prohibition, you usually get the best of the best because they want to, you know, focus on that. I said, why do you think that that's happened with LSD? And he said that primarily he was responsible for that, that back, you know, when there was so much heat on the production, it was hard to get the chemicals, it was hard to make it, get all the necessary you know, equipment and the like, and that they started making lower dose just to get more money out of the deal. So unfortunately, I like, not unfortunately, but I'm a fan of hallucinogenics, and I deplore the fact that it's very difficult to get very clean, high dose.
Absolutely. I do think that possibly, like, in the 60s, when hallucinogenics were really taking off, shall we say, that it wasn't really a kind of marketplace drug. It was more of a, you know, you'd get turned on by people, you know. What,
right.
Possibly, it's a drug that is not really, it doesn't sit well in the kind of economic discussion as well as some of the other drugs. That's just a personal point of view, that that it's a drug that's kind of given rather than sold.
You know? That's just
a personal point of view.
Well, it's all I can say is that from the real world experience, it's very difficult to come by, and it's kind of a shame. Of course, hallucinogenic mushrooms, magic mushrooms, have gained considerably in popularity here in the States because they're pretty easy to obtain.
Well, they were legal here until summer before last.
Same time of when Holland, when the Netherlands...
Roughly. But yeah. The most remarkable thing is that I used to know a guy who worked in the Home Office, you know, which is where they made the drug laws here. And when they were planning to introduce the new law, there was discussion held at what part of the year were they going to introduce the new law. And it is alleged, and I have this on quite reliable sources, that the decision to not make it legal in the July was largely based on not wanting to interrupt the summer music festivals and have too much of an uproar. So they actually, I think it became illegal on October the 1st of that year. So if it was safe enough to not make illegal immediately and to sort of just let it run for another few months, Why would it possibly be, something that you want to make illegal at all?
I know, it makes my head hurt when I try to think about how these politicians' minds work.
I mean, some of the stuff around it is quite remarkable. I think if they were applied in other laws, it would just be completely unacceptable. And we have new laws here in the UK which are applied to drug users, which would not be acceptable to mainstream population. And we have a recently introduced law where people's assets can be taken away for them prior to guilt being established in court.
That's a biggie here in the States. That's a huge deal.
If you're arrested for shoplifting or an offense like that, the police can demand that you take a drug test, and if you have a Class A drug in your urine or blood, you're then referred for a mandatory treatment assessment. Yeah. So even if it turns out that you weren't guilty of the crime and it was a mistake, the process has already started. Yeah. So, laws like that to the general public would just not be entertained here in the UK. But when it comes to drug users, they're just drug users, and we can use them as guinea pigs,
right,
to experiment with new laws. And I think that's really awful.
I do too. Sebastian, we're getting near the end of the hour, and I'd like to finish up by again thanking you for taking the time to come inside the Opium Den with us today. And I ask this of all of my drug policy reform friends. It's a two-part question. The first part is, how long do you think it'll be before Prohibition is repealed? And the second and more important part of the question, how would you, if you were given the task, how would you devise the market? What would the market look like if you had the opportunity to devise it?
On the time, whether it'll come about in my lifetime, I'm saying two or three years younger than you. So whether it'll be in our lifetime, I don't know. But how it would come about, I suppose there are things you could just do immediately, and there are some things which would probably take a little more sort of a little more thought. Yeah, I mean, how you deal with the stimulants like cocaine and speed is probably harder than how you deal with things like sort of cannabis and opiate type drugs. But I think that you could immediately make cannabis available like it is in Holland. You could probably move drugs like ecstasy that way as well. This whole notion of prescribing drugs, I think I don't have long enough to talk, because I think that, you know, pathologizing or medicalizing drug problems isn't always the best way forward. But clearly there are people who do benefit from being provided with, you know, clean, reliable sources of their drug of choice. So, and to really to have policies which, above all, reduce the harm that drugs potentially can cause, but most of all, reduce the harm that current drug policies cause. I suppose that's what I'd like to see. To sit and describe the exact model, I think, is not possible in a couple of minutes.
Okay, well, maybe we can save that for another time. And
I'd like that very much. And I've really enjoyed being on your show, Daniel, and I love the idea that we've been in an opium den. I think opium is probably one of the drugs which, you know, could really solve some of the opiate problems.
Without question. I find it to be a very pleasant substance. And I always ask this question as well, and please feel free to decline to answer. I would understand it completely. But, you know, you're 56 years old. Obviously, you've been involved in drug policy for some time. Do you have a favorite substance?
Well, I think I just indicated that, how much I enjoy being in the opium den.
Well, same back at you here, Sebastian. We certainly have appreciated you being inside the opium den today, taking the time out from your Sunday over there in London to give us your views. And what we'll do here is we'll have this uploaded to the archives section of the Opium Den in a few days, and you can have your friends over in the UK check it out and download it for free and listen to what you have to say. And I certainly, again, want to thank you for coming inside the Opium Day, Sebastian.
Thank you very much, and keep up your good work, too. And,
same to you.
Let's stay in touch.
Okay, thanks again, Sebastian.
Take care. Bye.
Bye now. Okay, that was Sebastian Saville, or Saville, I guess he was telling me how the pronunciation is over there, the executive director of Release. They are the drug policy group over in the UK who have stirred up quite a bit of controversy with their billboard signage on buses that say, "Nice people take drugs." And I'm speaking for all the nice people that take drugs here in the United States. And we hope that you enjoyed our conversation with Sebastian Saville. Again, Sunday, June 14th, 2009. Thank you for coming inside the Opium Den. And until we meet again, stay healthy and high when it helps.